Case number 278-93, Bang Drug Ricardo and Trip Ricardo versus TIG Hawaii Insurance Company Incorporated. Arguing for the petitioner, Ian L. Maddox, also appearing for the petitioners, Daniel P. Hurley. Arguing for the respondent, Jonathan H. Snyder. Argument on the merits.
Counsel, please proceed.
This matter occurred on May 23rd, 2002, when the petitioner, Bangdrej Guajardo, was walking close by Restaurant Road and was struck by a van that was being operated by Gary Sinaga, a member of this bar. The injuries were severe, and approximately a year after the accident happened, Ms. Guajardo retained our office to represent her in a claim. Mr. Sinaga had been insured with Progressive, and his coverage was for $100,000 for each injured person. The Guajardos had been longtime customers of AIG and had the foresight, in the event of a serious accident, to undertake UIM coverage that would pay in the event one of them were injured by an underinsured driver. We evaluated the claim and saw that probably the underlying bodily injury claim insurance would not be sufficient. And so on July 29th, 2003, wrote to Mr. Ross at AIG and suggested that a UIM file be opened. We thought that the claim would exceed the $100,000 of bodily injury coverage and that we were going to ask AIG to bring in to participate to adequately compensate Ms. Guajardo and her husband its $100,000 of UIM coverage. On July the 30th, Mr. Ross promptly wrote me back and suggested that if we intended to really make a UIM claim, it would be necessary for us to obtain a judgment against Mr. Sinaga to protect their subrogation or AIG's subrogation rights as required under her policy, and that's the Guajardo policy. A series of letters then passed back and forth between AIG and our office discussing the issue and starting to focus on whether or not, in fact, to protect the subrogation rights of AIG and to secure AIG's consent, we would need to actually take this claim to trial and obtain a judgment against Mr. Sinaga before we would be entitled to UIM proceeds. And that was irrespective of the fact of whether Progressive, in fact, tendered its policy limits. There was an exchange of information also as we went through August of 2003 and into September as to whether or not what was Mr. Sinaga's financial circumstances. Because he was a lawyer, Mr. Ross early on anticipated that Mr. Sinaga would at some point in time have adequate financial resources either from his salary or the buildup of assets to contribute or pay back AIG for the amount which it might have to pay under the UIM coverage. Interestingly, between the date of the accident and the date of the first letter to AIG, Judge Chang entered a decision in the Milo case and basically pointed out to AIG two very important facts, one of which was that it had no consent to settle clause in its UIM endorsement. It did have a clause in its UIM endorsement, but not in the UIM endorsement. Irrespective of this fact, Mr. Ross and subsequently counsel continued to insist that the plaintiff obtain consent in order to have access to UIM benefits. The other thing that Judge Chang said...
You did ask Mr. Ross in your July 29 letter, did you not, to assign this matter for a consent to settle determination?
Yes, I did.
Why did you do that?
I did that as a routine. Normally, we are used to seeing, such as in the GEICO policy, consent to settle language in the UIM endorsement. And that was an oversight on my part. I had assumed at that point in time that such a provision did exist, and no one ever tried to disabuse us of that fact, even though that was a critical issue in the Milo matter before Judge Chang. At any rate, on September 12, 2003, Progressive, in fact, did tender its $100,000. And it said that in exchange for the payment of that amount as general damages, we would be required to provide Mr. Sinaga with a full release. In fact, I think the record contains also correspondence from AIG or its counsel requiring whether or not a Taylor release would be available, and Progressive consistently said that it would not accept a Taylor release, they would require a full release. When the release was actually drafted, we were asked to indemnify against first and third party claims, which is a traditional paragraph that's requested. In other words, if Progressive pays its $100,000, Progressive is entitled to expect that DHS or somebody else that might hold a lien against the proceeds will not come back against it and say you disregarded our rights to receive payment as well. And that indemnity provision was given as part of the release that was signed and delivered to AIG, or to Progressive, rather, except for a qualification of unique language that said in the release that this did not apply to any attempt on behalf of AIG to make a claim. In other words, it was anticipated that at some point in time AIG would be making a claim for reimbursement after it had paid the UIM proceeds and really did have a subrogation claim to make.
I'm sorry, the release provided that the indemnification language would not apply to any subrogation claim that AIG might make?
Most specifically, Your Honor, it said that the subject accident arising by reason of injury to Bangja Guajardo or the care of treatment of Bangja Guajardo, provided that this agreement to defend, indemnify, or hold harmless shall not apply to any subrogation or collection claim or declaratory relief claim maintained by AIG Hawaii Insurance Co., Inc., its successors, or assigns.
In other words, by virtue of that language, the Guajardos would have no contractual obligation to indemnify AIG with respect to any claim that AIG made against Progressive?
That's correct. And we contend that that gives, in addition to all the other correspondence and communication, certainly gives Progressive an indication that a claim is going to be made and that there is that issue out there. In addition to that, the record reflects some communication prior to the settlement itself, advising AIG that there are advising AIG, yes, and Progressive as well, that we anticipated a UIM claim. And so this might be construed to be a warning to a knowledgeable party or its insurer of the pendency of such a claim and would qualify under the State Farm case. Following on in the chronology of events, we were on September 29, 2003, told that there was no hope for doing anything other than what had been suggested to us, and that is to take this matter all the way to trial, to expend monies that would be on the cost list of our clients, and also time, and our clients' time, to pursue a judgment against Mr. Sinaga, when in fact such a judgment was really unnecessary because Progressive had already agreed to pay the policy limits. In addition, during this letter exchange time up until the 29th, when we were advised by Mr. Steiner that there was the AIG refused to consent or to buy out the claim, there was a series of authorities that appeared in the Granger decision that were sent to AIG, coaxing it or suggesting to us that one way of perhaps resolving this matter would be for AIG to buy out the claim. In spite of the fact that AIG wanted us to proceed to judgment on the third-party claim at the cost and time of the plaintiff, AIG, curiously enough, was not prepared to buy out the claim, which, of course, is the remedy subsequently suggested in the Granger decision. The release was signed on January 7th, 2004. Its execution was preceded by the filing of a DEC relief action, which was brought by the plaintiffs. The DEC relief action sought to obligate AIG to pay the UIM benefits, and it also contained account for bad faith as well as account for punitive damages against AIG. On January 20th, shortly after the execution of the release in 2004, we sent the Mello decision to AIG. We had just discovered the decision and were happy to see what it had held. AIG denied the UIM claim despite Mello 6 days later. AIG files a motion for summary judgment on the bad faith and punitive damage aspects of the DEC relief on July 12, 2004. Both of the motions by the plaintiff compelling AIG to extend UIM benefits now that the BI proceeds have been paid, and a motion on behalf of AIG against the bad faith and the punitive damage aspects are filed before the court and heard on October 6, 2004. There is a granting of both of those summary judgment motions by order subsequent to that time, I believe in January of 2005. Subsequently, Granger's decided on August 9th, 2006. The ICA, who now hears the appeals that have been taken by the plaintiffs, enter a summary disposition order on October 27th, 2007. So that we have brought this matter before the court on a writ because we believe that the conduct of AIG clearly, almost as a matter of law, constitutes bad faith. When it refused during the period of time of the exchange of correspondence to agree to permit the Guajardos access to the UIM benefits, this conduct was unusual for the conduct and claims service in the community here in Hawaii. And it was also, in fact, contrary to the applicable law. In terms of our suggestion that there be a buyout, which is the Granger remedy, AIG took the position that there was no Hawaii law on that fact until Granger. That's probably true. A number of other jurisdictions, 12, and I believe in the recitation of those cases in Granger, there was no counter authority found, required its insurers to buy out a claim if, in fact, the UIM insurer, decided that it would not, it wanted to pursue a subrogation claim. We concede that there is a cooperation clause in the AIG policy. We thought that we had satisfied the requirements of that by previously saying that our clients would testify should AIG wish to pursue the claim. It could take an assignment of that claim and pursue the underlying Progressive Insurance and Mr. Sanaga's assets should it have wanted to. It chose not to do that. We believe also and have contended that there has been a misrepresentation of the terms and conditions of the policy when Mr. Ross, in his own letter, takes the position that to provide cooperation in the subrogation claim, the insured is required to take a case to trial. Such a contention to us was utterly surprising when that was what he said to us in the first letter back from our claims letter. No one had ever suggested in the somewhat many years of our practice that this was something that an insured should do. In Granger, I took note of the fact that the court said, and I think this is pretty consistent law, that when you pay an insurance company a premium to do something, you transfer the risk. And it seems to me that the entire history of this claim demonstrates that what was wanted here was a more than cooperation with subrogation, was wanting the plaintiff to process the subrogation claim on behalf of AIG, to shift that responsibility from the policy language that doesn't even mention such an obligation to the plaintiffs in this case after the payment of a premium. One wonders what the expectations of the plaintiffs would have been year after year prior to this accident when they purchased the UIM coverage. Certainly it was that if the funds available to the plaintiffs by the third party, Mr. Sinaga, were inadequate, that in fact the AIG or any UIM carrier would step up to the plate and provide the supplemental funds to hopefully fully compensate the injured party. Clearly that didn't occur here.
Now, AIG ultimately paid your client's UIM benefits, did it not?
It's interesting in the history how that happened. That's true. That was after we were forced to file a deck relief action, wait a considerable period of time for hearing on the motions, receive a decision on each summary judgment motion, ours and theirs, delaying the receipt of proceeds for much longer than would normally occur had these barriers not been erected.
What are your damages?
Delay in payment. At the time, the Guajardos were on very, and the record doesn't reflect this, responsive to your question. At the time, they were on hard economic times and they needed the money. And I think I've, in my correspondence with AIG, I've mentioned that fact, and that's in fact true. It wasn't a happy event for them to find out that the insurance company they had trusted for all these years and whose commercials they had seen on television promising prompt claim service, in fact, did not properly reflect the underlying reality in this matter.
When did AIG pay?
AIG paid the funds on November 22nd, 2004. It did not take into account the cost or the efforts that were necessitated by having to file a summary judgment or file a deck relief action against their own insurer. That's an item of damage that would probably come into play.
Was there a demand for that?
To
pay the attorney's fees and costs for pursuing the claim?
Well, that's an interesting issue. And there was, because of course, as the court knows, under the law, the losing party, at least on the first part of the on the declaratory relief matter in the first summary judgment brought by us, would be entitled to fees and costs. The only way we were able to motivate AIG to immediately pay those funds was to waive those fees and costs, to compel them or to entice them, rather, into doing what they should have done a long time ago, and that was pay the UIM benefits. So we did that, and it's a good indication of the economic unhappiness that the Guajardos were suffering at that time. It was not a personal issue for the Guajardos because we did not turn around and pass those costs or charge fees to our client. We viewed that as being part of the deck relief action. But certainly that is an economic benefit to AIG for doing what it should have done, as I said, a long time before. There is another aspect to the decision of the ICA that we are unhappy with, and that is under 56F, we needed to do some discovery to explore the parameters of the bad faith that AIG committed in this matter. There are a number of questions that we never had answered because we were concerned with whether or not there was an obligation to pay under the DEC relief. Coincidentally, the other motions for summary judgment were brought as well. We wanted to ask AIG whether or not we were the only people that this had happened to, how many UIM insured claims they had per year. I was very interested in knowing, for example, on the successful subrogation matters, when they did collect on subrogation, did the funds that were received in the subrogation, were they counted to determine what the UIM losses were for any given period of time in anticipation of setting next year's rates? You know, the suspicion I had, I suspect, was that our suspicion was that those proceeds were never taken into account in the rate-making procedures to determine what premiums the Guajardos would pay the next year had they continued to be AIG customers, which, of course, by this time, they had no interest in doing. We believe that we should be permitted to conduct that discovery. We believe that there's enough evidence in the record during the period of time that we were dealing with Mr. Ross up until the time when AIG ingeniously said, now that we know that Mr. Sinaga is aware of this claim, and now that we know that that the release that was given to Progressive, in fact, did not prejudice our subrogation rights, gee whiz, I guess it's okay to settle now. All of that happened around the hearing and the argument for summary judgment. That, again, was far down the road and a completely new position never suggested by AIG during the initial phases up until the time that we were forced to file our declaratory relief action. I think that in this particular case, between lambs and wolves, that the lambs are the Guajardos, and the other species may be the other parties involved in this matter. We feel that the conduct of AIG is reprehensible and that we should have a chance to explore the parameters of what is suggested to us in the 1996 decision in Best Place as to what the requirements of an insurance company are to act in good faith. Are those requirements that the payment to the insured who has made a premium payment, the payment of the UIM benefits in this case, not be denied? Are the requirements that dealing with the adversity that this entire claims process generated that the Guajardos had to participate in order to permit us to represent them, is that the type of thing that insurers should not subject their first-party insureds to? We think Best Place, as a matter of law, given the record of the correspondence, might give us a chance to claim that bad faith has been committed. But certainly, there is enough in this record to suggest that a summary judgment on the bad faith aspects, just because at the end of the whole matter, AIG was prepared to concede that perhaps the Guajardo release to Progressive did not disturb their subrogation rights. You know, that's a little late. Certainly it's a dollar short. We request the remedies that we've set out in our petition. We would like to revisit these matters on remand. We believe that we should be permitted to conduct our discovery if the conduct is sufficiently egregious. Maybe it is bad faith as a matter of law. I have reserved 5 minutes of time and thank the court if there are any questions.
Sorry. So the UIM benefits have been paid?
Yes.
And so your claim is essentially for the delay caused by AIG in settling the matter, so to speak.
Well, it's whatever damages are properly recoverable in a bad faith action, and I think it goes past.
Does AIG still have subrogation rights of those banks? Or?
They've exercised their subrogation rights. Mr. Sinaga was brought into, interestingly enough, into the deck relief action by AIG. And during that period of time, through a combination of matters that were sort of handled in court and also matters that were handled in mediation involving Mr. Sinaga and AIG, Mr. Sinaga's contribution was in fact determined and
so they did exercise, in effect, their subrogation rights.
Yes.
At one point, AIG recommended a global mediation with everyone involved. What happened to that suggestion?
Yeah, that did not occur. We believed that there was no issue as to value, so we thought that there was no reason to enter into mediation and incur those costs as to our clients. That suggestion, incidentally, was not the first time I'd heard that. It's always convenient if you want to settle your subrogation claim to get everybody together and participate in it. Our position is clearly if you have a subrogation claim and you've paid the money, you have the obligation to go out and pursue that claim as the insurance company that paid the money. And we felt, and I think that the law clearly reflects that right now, that the plaintiff and the insured, the first party insured, is in no way obligated to do that.
No way, but that would preserve, if the law were unknown or unsettled, both sides' interests, might it not?
It might have resolved the dispute, but the Mello case certainly was legal authority since it involved AIG that AIG should have followed. And if they had acknowledged the Judge Chang's decision that they didn't have a consent clause and that in fact prevented them from taking a tailored position in this matter, they should have started reviewing the claim on its merits certainly and paid the UIM policy limits as it finally did later on down the road. Thank you.
May it please the court, Jonathan Steiner on behalf of AIG Hawaii Insurance Company, Incorporated. I'd like to start by addressing some of the statements made in opposing counsel's chronology of the case, because I think that some things are mischaracterized. The first was the comment regarding the lack of any consent to settle clause in the insurance policy. There was no clause that says that we have a right to insist upon consent to settle. However, there was in the policy a provision that provided our right to subrogation and the fact that the insured shall do nothing to prejudice our right to subrogation and shall cooperate with that right. And it was on that basis, as well as upon the basis of the opinion of this court in the Taylor case, that the assertion was made that you've asked for our consent to settle. We can't give our consent to settle because our subrogation rights aren't being protected. Now, along those lines, I also would like to comment on Judge Chang's decision.
What communication are you referring to, Mr. Steiner, in which AIG took that position?
AIG, in a series of communications, the first communication that they point to is a letter from Mr. Ross back to opposing counsel, and this is in response to opposing counsel's letter where he says that they anticipate, and this is important, they anticipate a settlement offer from Mr. Sinaga, and they ask us to look into whether we're going to consent to settle. They provide us some information about Mr. Sinaga, which on its face indicates that he may have and probably does have some residual income. They asked for an assignment of a consent to settle. Now, it's important to note that Progressive hasn't actually made the tender yet. So Mr. Ross replies back that we're unable to give consent to settle. And he says...
Wasn't Mr. Ross, or doesn't Mr. Ross's July 30, 2003 letter unconditionally refuse to consent to settle?
That's one way to read the letter. However, I would point out that...
How else would you read, we are unable to give our consent for your client to settle her BI claim with Mr. Sanaga's insurance carrier? Mr. Sanaga is a deputy attorney general living at home with his parents. He certainly earns a good salary and has limited living expenses. On that basis, we will not consent to the BI settlement, since even though he may not have tangible assets, he certainly has future income to pay any excess judgment against him. If your client desires to make a UIM claim, it will be necessary for her to obtain judgment against Mr. Sanaga to protect our subrogation rights as required under her policy. What's not unconditional about that?
He indicates that we will not give our consent. However, a few days later, he says that they would be willing to work with Mr. Sanaga. In a letter dated July 4th, 2003, Mr. Ross responds back to a letter to Mr. Maddock, says that he'd be willing to work with Mr. Sanaga through his attorney to ascertain his amount of wealth and salary. At this point, AIG has information indicating that it has a subrogation right that it needs to protect. And
what about Mr. Ross's September 8 letter, in which he says, in answer to your question, should judgment be obtained against Mr. Sanaga, that's pursuant to an action brought by the Guajardos, there would be no need for AIG to consent to a settlement since there would be a judgment. I mean, that's just confirming. I told you we weren't going to consent to settle. You have to pursue the Mr. Sanaga to judgment to protect us. And once you have a judgment, settlement is irrelevant, and therefore there's no need to consent. AIG would not cover the cost of the action against Mr. Sanaga, nor would AIG pay our insured's attorney's fees.
Your Honor, that was in response to a request by Mr. Maddock that if, hypothetically, we were to go to judgment against Mr. Sanaga, one, would you consent then? The response is, well, there'd be no need. There'd be a judgment. There's no need to consent to settle. There's a judgment. And number two, no, we don't see anything under the law that requires us to pay the fees. The problem here, Your Honor, is that the circumstances where AIG was faced with was a result of jurisprudence that was still developing under the Taylor case. The Taylor case provided that an insurance company has a right to withhold consent to a settlement if its subrogation rights might be prejudiced. In this case, AIG had clear indication that its subrogation rights would be prejudiced. Because there was evidence, as provided, that Mr. Sanaga had residual income that would be available to protect a subrogation right.
Did Taylor entitle AIG to require the Guajardos to pursue Sanaga to judgment as a precondition to eligibility for UIM benefits?
The letter that was written on the 30th was perhaps inartfully drafted in that it indicated you're required to pursue them to judgment. But really, there was two options under the law as it was that AIG saw. Well, three options. One would be obtain a Taylor-type release.
Mr. Ross didn't say anything about a Taylor-type release, did he?
That's correct. He didn't. However, they were at the time...
Mr. Ross is
not a lawyer. Mr. Maddock is a lawyer. They were discussing the Taylor decision.
For what it's worth, the July 30 letter certainly looks like the unauthorized practice of law to me, especially when you compare it to the September 29, 2003 letter, which I believe was your first communication with Mr. Maddock, reflecting an absolutely correct understanding of the Taylor decision.
I would submit that in his role as litigation manager, he does have to deal with legal issues on quite often. And I don't think there's been any... Well, I wouldn't want to address before this court because it hasn't been fully briefed any unauthorized practice of law. But I think
it was a gratuitous comment, but in his September 8 letter, Mr. Ross invites Mr. Maddock to send him a copy of the best place decision so that he, or pertinent pages from it, so that he could review it. Wasn't September 29, 2003, in your letter, the first time that AIG expressed a willingness to process the Guajardo's UIM claim subject to, among other things, a Taylor release?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is the first time in writing that that was set forth. I would point out, however, that if you look at the correspondence carefully, the letters that preceded that, Mr. Maddock was talking about we anticipate an offer from Progressive. Progressive's offer, where he tenders on behalf of Sinago, was first communicated on September 12, 2003. Our letter comes shortly on the heels of that. So I would submit that if there was an error of law, that there was no prejudice, because either way, AIG was faced with a situation where the law was unclear. The gist of their claim is that two things. One, they should have bought out the Sinago's claim. Two, Pacific Rental preserved their subrogation rights anyway. Both of those questions involved unsettled issues of law. First, the buyout of the claim. Taylor doesn't talk about a buyout of the claim. Taylor talks about the possibility of obtaining this Taylor release.
Isn't there at least a genuine issue of material fact as to whether it was reasonable for AIG through Ross on July 30 to condition the possibility of UIM benefits upon the Guajardo's taking Sinago to judgment?
I would submit that if there is an issue of fact as to that, there are no damages that resulted from that. The damages they've talked about is that there was a delay. There would have been an inevitable delay. If he had said the correct statement, which was that you need to either obtain a Taylor release.
This is a claim for relief sounding in tort, is it not?
Yes, it is.
What about general damages?
I think under the best place decision, one of the elements of bad faith is you have to have actual damages. And I would submit that there are no damages. It would be a case of no harm, no foul. An error.
One can say that as a matter of law?
I'm sorry?
No damages as a matter of law.
At the time the statement was made that you need to you need to obtain a judgment. If they had run out and pursued a judgment,
if
then they
would. If the Guajardos can prove a delay in payment, then there's some special damage, is there not?
That's correct. However,
and if there's some special damage, they would be entitled to seek general damage, would they not?
But there's even
a potential for punitive damages, is there not?
There is a potential for punitive damages, but only if you get past the actual damages. And I would submit that a delay would equal damages, but the delay in this case was inevitable because of the state of the law, because of the unsettled law under Pacific Rental and the unsettled law under Taylor. If Mr. Ross had instead written, you have to either pursue them to judgment or obtain a Taylor release, which would have been a correct statement, if he had written my letter, which you indicated said the correct statement of law, the same thing would have happened. There would have been a declaratory judgment action filed. There would have needed to be a determination as to whether the Pacific Rental case applies in the setting of UIM coverage. And I'd like to point out, in fact, that still remains an unsettled question of law, even though that was the basis upon which Judge Iabi made his decision in this case. There's more recently
Didn't the release that the Guajardos executed in settling with Progressive foresee on its face a subrogation claim by AIG?
That's correct. But the Pacific Rental, the State Farm versus Pacific Rental case that said if you have constructive knowledge, your subrogation rights are preserved, specifically states that it's in the context of a of fire and casualty insurance. It specifically limits it there.
Isn't it also the case that the release that the Guajardos executed in no way prejudiced AIG subrogation rights?
No, that's not correct. It did, in fact. It released Mr. Sanaga completely. It did not preserve the rights unless you apply the Pacific Rental. It specifically said on its face, we release the rights. What it protected was the Guajardos from having to come in and indemnify Mr. Sanaga, not AIG, but Mr. Sanaga, for any claim for subrogation brought. So his release gave constructive knowledge to Mr. Sanaga, and he, when we brought him in as a party, he admitted, yes, I had constructive knowledge, but I still think that I should be released. We needed a court to determine that, yes, under Pacific Rental, your subrogation rights are preserved because Judge Ayabi said, I'm going to apply this to the situation of UIM coverage. And I just want to point out one thing that's important because there was a recent case. Recent decision just in June of 2007, the Buescher versus Boning case, where an argument was made in the context of a workers' comp and the state giving consent to settle, and the state had refused to consent to a workers' comp settlement, and an argument was made, well, what about Pacific Rental? The rights are preserved. And in a footnote, this court said that to the extent defendants are arguing about Pacific Rental, they said that doesn't apply for one reason, and then they say, and because Pacific Rental was decided, quote, in the context of fire and casualty insurance and not the context of the workers' comp statute. So again, it's still an unsettled question of law whether the Pacific Rental case applies at all beyond the fire and casualty.
It's rather moot now, right, with Granger. With Granger, isn't it pretty much moot?
Exactly. And Granger is the whole point.
Just to clarify what happened below, so you're saying Mr. Sanaga did contribute to this overall disposition because Judge Ayabi had said Pacific, whatever it is, applied?
Yes, exactly. What happened was...
And in that sense, your subrogation rights were preserved despite the fact that a journal release had been signed by the Fajardo.
Yes, but we've thought it was very important that we bring Mr. Sanaga in so that he could assert his right to say, no, Pacific Rental doesn't apply. What we didn't want is a situation where we said, okay, Pacific Rental applies. We are able to go ahead because our subrogation rights are preserved.
I'm sorry. Did AIG conduct an investigation?
AIG was provided information.
Did AIG conduct an investigation?
It evaluated the information that was provided to it.
So it did not. It did not conduct an investigation.
I would disagree with that. It evaluated.
Well, it received information.
It received information which was voluntarily. That the chronology shows that on almost immediately after this correspondence started, Mr. Maddock on July 31st says, hey, I've prepared some interrogatories about assets. I'm going to send them out.
Right. The Fajardos and Mr. Sanaga were very accommodating. But did AIG conduct its own independent investigation?
There's no law that indicates that it had to conduct an independent investigation.
Whether or not there is a law to that effect, as far as you understand it, did AIG conduct its own independent investigation?
It did not conduct any affirmative independent investigation other than evaluating the information that was provided. But I want to point one thing out in that regard, which is that the trigger of AIG needing to make a final decision, whether it had prejudged it or not, but the trigger of actually making a final decision on the consent to settle would ipso facto be when Progressive actually tenders. So when did that occur? Progressive actually tenders to Sanaga, or on behalf of Sanaga, on September 12, 2003.
But your investigation goes beyond tender. It goes to your ability to obtain reimbursement under your right of subrogation. There was a delay, and can reasonable minds agree whether or not there was a delay caused in this case? Can reasonable minds disagree?
I think not, because I think all the alleged delays were inevitable because of the open question of law that under the Anoka case, this court just said if there's an open question of law, as a matter of law, it's not...
It's clear Taylor does require an investigation.
Taylor requires a good faith investigation. It doesn't require an independent investigation. If somebody comes to you and says, I have these facts, and you say, yep, I agree with those facts, and those facts show we have a subrogation right, why does AIG need to go out and...
We may differ on that requirement, but assuming an investigation is required, and in some way there may be some connection to delay, would interest for delay on payment of the UIM benefits be a measure of damages?
It'd be a possible measure of damages if there were such a delay. But I would submit, and I want to...
If there were not such a delay, would nominal damages be able to be awarded for breach of any duty or obligation on the part of AIG?
I don't think nominal damages are enough.
Well, nominal damages don't have to go to actual damages. Isn't that true? Well, assuming it is true, you can tack on punitive damages to nominal damages, can you not?
If, in fact, nominal damages are enough to support a claim for bad faith, then you possibly could tack on punitive damage, although it'd be subject to the constitutional limits of the United States Constitution.
Well, that only would apply if, in fact, punitive damages were awarded.
Yeah, but if...
But we're not even at that point.
We're not even at that point. Well, one thing on the delay, if I may, if I could just point out that the date of the tender by Progressive, the 12th of September 2003, that same day, AIG is provided with sworn... testimony or a sworn affidavit and a report from Dr. Laudat that same day, the day of the tender where an actual decision on consent, the day when the Guajardos would actually get the money, the $100,000, that same day, they also get all the information they need that on its face is clear that there is assets available. So what happened before... But before Progressive tenders, how can there have been a delay? There's no delay until they actually make the tender.
Well, whether the investigation was reasonable or not, or whether it was reasonable for AIG to accept at face value the documents presented to it, would depend on whether AIG's conduct was reasonable under the circumstances.
That's correct. If we submit it was...
Usually reasonableness... would be up to a fact finder?
Well, yes, but where information is provided to you by the other side and you say, yes, I agree with that, why do you need to go out and investigate?
The open question of law that you referred to before, I take it, was the question answered by Granger.
There's two open questions of law. That's one of them, yes.
All right. Granger was decided in 2006.
Correct.
What was the other one?
The other one is, and it still remains an open question of law, is the Pacific Rental issue, whether or not our subrogation right was preserved.
AIG actually paid UIM to the Guajardos in 2004?
Correct.
When both questions were still open?
Yes, because...
Now, the Part G right to recover payment language that you alluded to earlier... Take it that it's your position that by releasing Sanaga from any further liability to the Guajardos were breaching their duty to do whatever was necessary to enable AIG to exercise its subrogation rights and was prejudicing AIG's, the viability of AIG's subrogation claim.
Correct.
And if you are correct, that breach would relieve AIG of any obligation to pay UIM benefits to the Guajardos, isn't that so?
That's correct.
Why did AIG pay UIM benefits to the Guajardos?
Because the entire matter was resolved in a deck action. In the deck action that was filed, there were two things that were resolved. One, the court affirmatively said, I find Pacific Rental in this case applies in the UIM context. That's number one. So we have a court decision on that issue, and sure, it hasn't gone up to the Supreme Court, but in this case, we have a decision, we follow the law of the court. That's number one. Number two, the court also found that because of that, there was no prejudice to the subrogation right. And I want to point out that AIG actually advocated that position, and Mr. Maddock tries to say this was a new position that we came up with after the release came out. What happened is the deck action was filed. After that, they issued this release. We immediately, in response to the summary judgment, said, wait a minute, this is premature. We have a motion outstanding to bring Mr. Sanaga in as a party because he has rights here that could be affected by the decision on whether Pacific Rental applies. We affirmatively went out. We brought Mr. Sanaga in as a party. We made sure he had an opportunity to brief the issue. He admitted that he had constructive knowledge. In both of our pleadings, we urged the court that they should adopt the Pacific Rental position, and that therefore our subrogation rights should be preserved. And in that case, there's no breach of the policy. But we're sort of under a Hobson's choice. We face the prospect of possibly having a determination on the one hand that the subrogation rights were preserved in a case with only the Guajardos. And then Mr. Sanago could come in and say, well, no, wait a minute, Pacific Rental doesn't apply. That's only fire and casualty context, not UAM context. And if he won, there goes our subrogation rights. It made sense to bring it all together into one proceeding. And, you know, I want to comment on Mr. Maddock's comment that this conduct was so unusual in this case. If you look at the facts in the Granger case, they're very similar. This is not a novel position that was being taken by only AIG. Now, there may have been some insurance companies that chose to elect the buyout provision that was advocated in some of the cases, and I'll mention that buyout possibility is noted in some cases that were actually rejected by this court in the Taylor case. So it was far from certain that was the way this court would go, and Mr. Ross pointed out to Mr. Maddock in his early letters that this, in fact, was an issue that was on its way up to the Supreme Court. Made it clear right from the beginning this was an open question of law that needs to be resolved. And
do you concede, at the very least, that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to the reasonableness of Mr. Ross's insistence that as a precondition to the payment of any UIM benefits, the Guajardos would have to take Sanaga to judgment at their own expense?
I would concede that if that was in a vacuum, possibly that might raise that is a question of fact, but because there was no harm caused by that, because of the lack of clarity in the law until the Granger decision came out, that...
So your answer is, in effect, yes, there is a genuine issue of material fact as to that, but it doesn't matter because there are no damages.
Not just because there are no damages, but that one statement of incorrect law does not a bad faith case make. You have to look at the entirety of
the procedure. Yes, there's a genuine issue as to that, but that is insufficient to establish bad faith.
Exactly. I also want to just correct some more things for the record, because the decision in the Mello case that Mr. Maddock says that we should have been aware of, that we should have known, The court noted there was no consent to settle clause in the policy, but that wasn't the holding of the court. The holding of the court was that Pacific Rental preserved AIG's subrogation rights, so there was no prejudice. It wasn't that they can prejudice your subrogation rights. It was Pacific Rental applies in this case. I'm going to apply it in the UM context. But again, just because Judge Chang at the circuit court level says it applies in a different case doesn't mean that whatever case comes up when Mr. Sanaga is a party is going to make the same decision. They're not bound by decisions of other circuit court judges. They're bound by appellate court decisions, and there was none. Finally, I think if you look at the record, there's no indication anywhere, and I don't know whether it happened or not, but there's no indication in the record that I could find that Progressive was ever asked for a Taylor release and refused to provide one. There's correspondence about preserving the subrogation rights, but there's no letter from Mr. Maddox saying, I asked for a Taylor release, they refused to give one. Rather, the argument was always, hey, you've got to buy this claim out. And that simply wasn't the law at the time. And so what's the option? If you don't buy the claim out, there's two possibilities. You either pursue to judgment or you obtain a Taylor-type release. At this point, now it's certain because of the Granger case. Now AIG has the guidance, knows what to do. If AIG did the same thing today...
Well, at least until your September 29 letter, AIG wasn't asking for a Taylor release, was it?
That's correct. They did not ask for a Taylor release, nor was one ever offered. I think that if there are letters where they say... If something can be provided that preserves our subrogation right, and I'm looking through my chronology here to see whether I can.
Well, your September 29 letter states, among other things, AIG would not withhold consent to a settlement which preserves its right of subrogation.
Yeah, and that's a few months after the first letter saying we anticipate a settlement. It's within 2 weeks of when a tender is actually made. Inevitable under the circumstances, if Progressive was not going to give a Taylor-type release, that this was going to go the way that it ended up doing. It wasn't open to question at all. I think the Anok case controls, and there should be, as a matter of law, no bad faith in this case. I see my time's up. There's nothing further. Thank you.
Your Honor, just to respond to a couple of contentions. First of all, Milos definitely talks about no consent to settle clause in the AIG release, and the transcript amply reflects that. The facts of Milo are interestingly similar to Guajardo. Also interestingly, as Judge Chang says, well, why don't we just follow the law in the State Farm versus Pacific Rental case? This, of course, occurs before any of the initial correspondence from our office to Mr. Ross. I heard counsel, I think I heard him say, we were okay with Judge Iabi making that ruling. We were comfortable with that. We didn't have to go to the Supreme Court to get that ruling. And yet, for some reason, they had that ruling in the case involving them 6 months before our case even arose. And apparently, they're uncomfortable with what Judge Chang had to say. Now, I don't know how you reconcile that, but clearly Mr. Ross, who is at the head of claims, has knowledge of the Mello decision. There is, in our brief that we initially filed, a reference to the transcript where I represent to the court, and that representation was unchallenged, that I had asked Progressive, I was pretty desperate to get this UIM matter moving. And, you know, maybe there are other things out there. I don't know. But I have to tell you, this was the first time I'd ever been told that we had to pursue a claim to judgment on the underlying claim with the cost and the time that would be attendant to that. I mean, rather than the months it took to get the UIM benefits from AIG, it would have taken years probably to do that. Also, there is a letter, there's a paragraph in page 2 of the letter to us, I believe, September 29, 2003 letter from Mr. Steiner, where it is stated, AIG would not withhold consent to a settlement which preserves its right to, of subrogation against Mr. Sinaga. By way of a copy of this letter to Mr. Sinaga and Progressive, AIG hereby proposes this as a possible solution to the impasse the situation has created. So I suspect that that is the request for a Taylor release stated in counsel's letter to us on September 29, 2003. And that letter, and I assume the consul did what he said he was going to do, and details on the third page of that letter where he copies Gary Sinaga, Sue Grable, and Jeff Frost. It was not an unknown event. That did happen. In the end, I suspect that there were a number of ways that those UIM benefits could have been paid. It did not require a deck relief, and then this convenient, all of a sudden, finding that Gary Sinaga knows that there's a claim outstanding against him, and even though the release is not a Taylor release, nonetheless, under the authority in the State Farm case, certainly he is vulnerable to a subrogation claim. That is entirely different than the scenario that initial correspondence where it says you take this claim and you reduce it to judgment at your cost. That's why I was asking them. I just wanted to see what they'd say. That is our fees, our costs, our client pays us, this reduces. I mean, you can think of a scenario where even though you'd bought $100,000 of UIM coverage, if you did what Mr. Ross proposed to us and what I think the court properly characterized is unequivocal language, if you did what he said to do, even though you had $100,000 to claim against in the end, you may well have dissipated the entire $100,000 that Progressive
paid. Mr. Steiner's September 29 letter essentially retracts that position, though, doesn't it?
Maybe. We waited long and hard. It took until 2004, over a year after this letter, before Mr. Sinaga was ever paid his UIM benefits. I don't know what was going on in the mind of AIG. All I know is what they told us.
Well, I mean, at the very least, the September 29 letter retracts the position that the only way the Guajardos are ever going to see any UIM benefits is by taking Sinaga to judgment at their own expense.
I suspect I should concede that because they propose other remedies, other ways that were known at the time of getting to that place. And yet still, again, it took over a year to get to the point where they were willing to make payment. And that's when we had to concede our statutory fees on the deck relief action that we were successful in.
Even in fact, representing a plaintiff complied with the request that you obtain a judgment, you'd be in a pretty good position to obtain attorney's fees and costs from that side.
Right.
Reimbursement from
right.
If you had done it. So it wasn't a loss, really a loss to your client.
If we had pursued
the contract.
Beg your pardon. Under our contract, we are required to represent for the personal injury action. As an accommodation and full service to our client, we get into these deck reliefs from time to time simply because we run into positions which I would suggest to this court patently unreasonable.
Now, the law is that, you know, where you obtain enough judgment to pay off those subrogation claims of other, you know, hospital claims, or they have to reimburse you for reasonable attorney's fees and costs for obtaining that.
That is used as a negotiation. There is no legal authority that I know of, except under the workers' compensation statute, where that's mandated. If, for example, if Queens Hospital has a bill.
This situation, where your situation, where a demand is made for you to represent, that's how you view it, to represent their subrogation rights and obtain their whatever damages, $100,000 or whatever amount, you would very likely obtain attorney's fees and costs for your effort.
Well, I asked AIG if they were willing to pay that, and they said no. I don't know of any way to compel it.
Standing up to what the law is. So.
No. No, it isn't, Your Honor, except in workers' comp, there's a clear deduction from the workers' comp reward. The workers' comp carrier gives up a portion of what it's entitled to. But I have no privity of contract with any sort of a medical provider or any of those people. But very candidly, when we start to think of how much of our clients' money goes to get paid, we take that into account and we suggest that they should deduct from the amounts being paid to them what the reasonable cost of managing to recover those monies for them is.
But that's in fact, Mr. Ross, in one of his letters, expressed his opinion that he was unaware of any legal obligation on AIG's part to pay your costs and attorney's fees.
Absolutely. The question was posed to him, and he said no. That's part of the record.
Further?
No, Your Honor.
Take this matter under advisement.